Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Kicking off my brand new podcast this week, I am chatting to the legend that is DJ Zinc. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And
you're welcome.
You're welcome. Does legend mean you don't know when to give up?
No, legend means the person who has got me into drum and bass from a young, young age. And I've seen how your career has taken all sorts of twists and turns. And I thought you were an incredible person to start off with because I've seen you go through so many different genres.
Well, yes, so I wasn't fishing for a compliment, but it's very, very kind of you to say it like that. Yeah, I've done different genres. I've made music of different genres over the years. And
you've probably been doing it for my, I don't mean to make you feel old, but you've probably been doing it for my entire lifetime.
Yeah, probably.
Professionally.
yeah. Which year were you born?
94.
So in 1994, I'd already been on Pirate Radio for 3 years. And in 1994, I just started, that's when I met DJ Hype around that time. So I started developing the productions that I was working on. In 1993, I made my first track through somebody I'd met from Pirate Radio.
Right.
And then, by 94, 95 was when I was meeting the other DJs in club environments. And that was when I was, developing. I met Hype. He was really helpful with my production. And so 94, that was just before I did Super Sharpshooter. So yeah.
That's madness to me. I mean, look, the reason why I've asked you here today is because this podcast I wanted to create was an idea that was about educating my generation of ravers how rave has changed over the years.
Okay.
Because I think I definitely kind of, especially when I go out raving now, I definitely feel like something has changed. That's quite big. I feel like pirate radio isn't really a thing anymore. Well, if it is, you know, I listen to a lot of, and my brother especially, we listen to a lot of online radio stations.
Right.
But I felt like pirate radio was a whole movement in itself.
It was incredibly important. And I was really lucky that I grew up in East London and could listen to pirate radio. If you weren't in the right area, you couldn't listen to the music.
Oh, of course. Because there was only a certain bandwidth, right?
Exactly. There's only a certain radius, a certain area that the radio stations transmit to. So, I so many years and stories of doing that stuff where people would talk about the equipment that we could get out further, and can you get, you know, we would be on the radio and we could get to Southend, and it was such a big deal because you can hear us in Southend.
And would you be climbing on the roof and tinkling with the
a little bit, but not that much, but a little bit, a few times, which is it was incredible to be on top of the tower blocks in London.
I bet
23, 24 floors up. It was just incredible, and you're on top of the tower block. There's no barriers or staff or, it's just you're on top of the roof, and if you fall off, I didn't go near the edge, but it was incredible. It was like really, really exciting.
Was there rivals? Was there a rival?
Yeah, there was rivals, and occasionally the radio stations would pinch each other's transmitter or their aerials and that sort of stuff. And
right,
there was a bit of rivalry, but more recently, when I say more recently, I mean like since 96 or something, you know. I think there's a lot of camaraderie between the radio stations. They help each other out. And
right.
So I started working with the Rinse guys in, I don't know, 2005, 6, around about then maybe. And they would help out Cool FM with their transmitter, and they would both use the same guy to do the transit. You know, they'd help each other out. So
pirate friends.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the pirates can be friends sometimes. So pirate radio was incredibly, incredibly important for the rave scene. And when I started, some of the pirates were not on at the weekends, let alone during the week. So you could sometimes hear them, and but most of the time not. So I left school, started work when I was 16, and in every night would try and tune into these pirate radios to try and find one. And quite often there was nothing you could hear. And now, if you're 16 and you've just left school, or you're going to university or doing whatever, you go onto YouTube and you find it. You go onto here, you go onto SoundCloud and you find it. There isn't, you don't have the same restrictions in what you can find. And so very, very significant.
Do you think that being the case, do you think that is that a positive or a negative? Has that made radio less of a special thing? Because for me, if I was a kid in East London trying to tune in when I got the right bandwidth, I would feel like I had made a major accomplishment. So do you think that now technology has developed so much and we've got all of the stations at our fingertips, do you think that's a good thing for my generation, or do you think that has kind of watered it down slightly?
I think that it is, with nearly everything to do with progress and technology, I think that it's 90% good and 10% bad.
Right.
And, you know, I was very frustrated that I couldn't find music that I wanted to listen to.
Right.
You know, you might go to a rave on a Saturday and you would hear this music, but you would hear it in a club environment, so it's like the noise is bouncing around on the walls, and I never used to drink or do anything like that, so I was always really like clear-headed and paying attention to the music. But nevertheless, how a tune sounds in a club versus how a tune sounds on the radio is very different. The same tune can sound completely different. So I'd be hearing these tunes thinking, you know, what's the one that goes da da da, what's the one that goes like this, and then waiting during the week to see if possibly a pirate radio DJ is going to play that same tune. It was really hard to find the music that you wanted to listen to. You could get the tape packs from certain raves, but then that would be a few weeks after the rave, and again you're limited to hearing what those club DJs are playing. So it was, for me, it's like it's 90% better now. The 10% is that the way it's not better is that you used to really have to work hard to find this stuff. So when you found it, I think you had, you know, like you say, a sense of accomplishment.
Yeah.
If there was a song that you had heard for a year in clubs and you don't know what this tune is, and it goes dun 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 dun, and you go into shops and they say, I don't know what that is, and you go into all these places and you're singing it and they say, I don't know what it is, and then you get the record, you're just like, yes. It is what it is. By Rhythm is Rhythm. This is what it is. I wonder what it was, and that's what it is. I used to work in a record shop, and people used to come in and sing bass lines from songs.
Where did you work in a record
shop? I worked in Boogie Times.
Where was
in
that?
In Watford, which was the label that Suburban Bass. It was the shop, the label Suburban Bass, which was one of the biggest jungle drum and bass labels.
No way.
They had a shop called Boogie Times. I used to work there on a Saturday.
So did you used to have people coming in being like, I've got this song, dun, 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 dun.
Yeah.
And you would have to be the human Shazam.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, completely. And I mean, I had for years gone into shops singing bass lines and saying, what's the one that goes, no one can compete because I heat like a fireball. And they would say, that's Fireball by Chrome and Time. You know, and then now I was on the other side with people coming in and having to try and exactly human Shazam.
Oh, I have so many questions about this, but let me, as you were singing the bass line.
Yeah, so the bass line I just sang was It Is What It Is, which is one of the first tracks that when I first got into electronic music, this was one of the tracks that stood out for me, and it's still one of my favourite tracks of all time. And it's like the kind of blueprint for everything I've done since.
Right.
So it's...
this is the tune that was in 1988, right?
Exactly. So it's got a big bass line. It's got quite moody elements to it.
Yeah, let's play It Is What It Is, Rhythm Is Rhythm.
This is one of the ones where I went into the shop and sung the bass line, you know.
Do So
Was It Is What It Is by Rhythm Is Rhythm.
You're good at this, man.
Smashy and nicey, come on.
So we were just saying while that was playing, I really liked the synth strings, which were kind of classic sounding 80s synth strings.
Yes.
And I was saying to you how it still sounds really quite fresh to this day.
One of the things about those synths and that era that makes it, that means that you can tell quite straight away that is an 80s sound, that is an 80s synth, is that the synths weren't tuned digitally. Right. They were tuned manually. So I've got like 8 or 10 of these keyboards at home. And if you play a middle C on one of them and middle C on another one, when you first turn them on, it's going to be a completely different note. And then you have to tune it up. You do it by ear. So all of these keyboards, you tune them by ear. And so, and then the tuning drifts slightly. So invariably, none of them are perfectly in tune with each other. And it means that you get this really like thick analog sound.
Right.
It's a bit like if you've got, you know, if you have like 4 violins and you have 12 violins, you can tell that there are 12 because it just sounds thicker and bigger and more lush. And yeah. I think that's because they're all very slightly out of tune with each other because, you know, the person's using their finger.
Well, it's the same with vocals, right? This is why we do double tracks instead of just layering up vocals, the same vocal underneath each other.
Exactly.
Because you'll never do the same vocal take that is the same as the other. So you fill it up, bigger sound.
And with vocals, I think that if you have, you can hear a track nowadays that doesn't have a lot of auto-tune because there's something about it that sounds like kind of unusual compared to most pop.
Yeah.
And so...
Less clean, I suppose.
Yeah, and just, you know, there will be a load of words to describe it from, you know, that are good words or bad words, but essentially you can tell the difference. Mm-hmm. And I think that with a lot of the newer keyboards from maybe, you know, like 2000 or whatever, they had... digital tuners, so they're all in tune with each other much more, and so it was a different sort of sound. Then when we were all using plugins, it's like perfectly in tune, but then they've started kind of doing emulations of the old stuff because there is something about the old stuff that has like a sort of soul, so that was and that track we listened to is a great example of that, where it kind of just sounds kind of wide and warm and, you know, it works
like a big acid house hug.
Yeah, exactly.
So I want to talk to you about mainly the rave, because you mentioned that you would go to clubs and hear these tunes and then turn up at record shops singing these bass lines.
Yep.
What age were you raving from? How long were you raving? Do you still rave? Do you when did you stop? Did you start? Did you when you start working in clubs?
When you say raving, what do you mean?
Well, my definition of raving is kind of going out to a club, dancing to the music, and spending more than 4 hours there.
Yeah, I think I still go to raves because I work at raves, and so I still hear a lot of the music and enjoy the music. Mm-hmm. For example, I was at a festival this weekend, and my friends were playing in the other room, and I went and stood there for half an hour and really enjoyed they were playing some new music, and I'm very into new music.
Yeah.
So I still listen to a lot of rave music in that environment. I started when I was 16, 17, and for the listeners of this podcast, we are currently in King's Cross.
Right. You used to go to Bagley's, right?
And this is where Bagley's was. Probably, from where we are, we can look out of the studio window and see a building, and that building was Bagley's, right? So there was...
I've heard so much about this club. It was supposed to be legendary.
Yeah, it's legendary. It's one of these things, like, at the time, it was like, not a crap hole, but it was a bit like, you know, Bagley's, you know, sweat coming off the ceilings and, you know, it wasn't,
those lovely,
it's not like
clubs.
Super sophisticated, it was grimy. It was a warehouse. It was not a warehouse that was, and this area was, they knew they were going to do it all up. So they, from the warehouse was closed until they said, you know, you've got 10 years until we're actually going to regenerate the area.
Damn.
And so somebody said, right, let's have a rave for 10 years. And so, so that building that we can see, that your listeners can imagine, is Bagley's, and so there were hundreds of raves there from all different kinds of music, and I used to go there, but that was after, quite a while after I'd started being involved, and that's more like, I guess, late 90s,
Right. Okay. I mean, this is why I wanted to do the podcast at Spiritland, because I feel like, A, this is quite a muso kind of restaurant, cafe, bar, whatever you want to call it. And also because, I mean, I've heard a lot about Bagley's. And again, this is something that I find I get, being 25, I get rave jealousy.
FOMO. What is it? It's not fear of missing out. It's
fear that I have missed out.
Fear of missing out, yeah.
Which is why I started this podcast, because I really wanted to get to know what it was like back in the day with raving and kind of like playing clubs. I mean, this is like a general thing, whether you were there dancing to it or playing it. So when that was all going on in the late 90s, early noughties, what was the atmosphere at raves like? Because I know what they're like now. But I don't have anything to compare it to, but the thing, like, I get the impression that people were a lot more engaged back in the day.
I think that one of the things about nostalgia is that it's we're selective in our memories. Mm-hmm. when we are thinking back on times, and we tend to remember the good things and not the bad. If I look back on it, I say, oh yeah, it was so great, the warehouses, yeah, you'd be in this warehouse. But what I forget is that being in a warehouse generally means the sound is crap, because it's just bouncing around over the walls. And so I think that the thing is that it was just less well organised.
Right. Because I think, I know...
Sorry to spoil your dream of this amazing rave experience
you missed out on. You made me feel a lot better, actually.
Yeah, I think that...
I still have a great time.
I think that one thing I've noticed over the years is that when people are talking about the sort of history of raving and this sort of stuff, is they... a good example is I was walking into a club in China, and as I was walking through, a bloke said to me, you are going to play something from the golden era, aren't you? So I said, I think, yeah, probably. And but what he meant was his golden era. So what he meant was the golden era that when he first got into raving,
right,
that's his golden era.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was on that night playing some stuff from all different ages. So I thought I'd probably get one or two that he likes. Mm-hmm. But for him, there is only one golden era.
Yeah.
Because he you know, it's hard to be... objective about something that's so subjective, but I think people often think of their when they first went raving as being the sort of when it was good, and then afterwards, oh, it's not so good anymore, the music's crap, and before is just only whatever you can find on YouTube. But you know, I think another example is that when I started making breakbeat, people were saying to me, oh, why don't you get back to your roots? And my roots is, it is what it is, what we just heard. Or when I was making house, they're like, get back to your roots. Actually, my roots is 127 BPM, 4/4 with a bass line. I mean, you know, and my roots is also some breakbeat stuff and blah, blah. But what they meant is they want me to get back to their roots.
Yeah.
And so...
Good point, actually.
Yeah, so I think that you know, there were... If you speak to somebody that was raving in 88, they'll say, that was the best time ever. And it hadn't really happened before, so it was new and it was exciting.
Yeah.
But ever since then, I think that if you were 17 or 18 in 1994, you would have been going to the jungle raves in Bagley's or whatever, and you would say, that was the era, that was amazing, da, da, da. You know, and nowadays it's not as good. If you were going out in 98 or 99, going to the end, when the end was tearing in there, you'd say, my God, that was the best ever. That was the best club in London ever.
You mentioned the end to me, didn't you?
Right, yeah. So the end, you know, was an amazing club. But if you started going out in 2000 and if you started going to Forward in 2007 when dubstep was just coming through.
Yeah,
right,
I was there.
Right. Then you will say that was, you know, that is it. A lot of people cite that Forward at Plastic People as being the most perfect club experience ever.
Yeah, I remember, well, I wasn't at the clubs, but I do remember the dubstep whole era as well. But then I'm not sure. My first rave experience was Fabric on a Players' Night.
Right. Fabric, again, is an incredible club. And if that was your first experience, you might think that is the best clubbing has ever been. And since then, you might go to other places and say, it's not quite what Fabric used to be on a Friday night. You know, that last Friday of the month or the first Friday, that was incredible. But I think that we do that generally. If that messes up your podcast, Becky.
But seriously, because I think it's important for me to find this sort of stuff. And And I wanted to speak to you because you've been outside of drum and bass, because drum and bass is very much a bubble in itself. The scene is a very much a bubble scene.
I think inevitably, because the music is a different tempo. It's like it was always a satellite scene. If you're into techno, you can be a bit into tech house, or you can be into, you know, if you're a techno DJ, you can play a bit of house or a bit of tech house.
100%.
But drum and bass is out there on its own.
What would you say is your golden era?
I think I'm an oddity in that I've had like a few golden eras. I've had a few times when I've felt like really moved by a new sound. And so the first for me was the sort of acid house. So that track, It Is What It Is.
Yeah.
And then the next track I wanted to play is Terminator by Goldie. And that was...
It's a tune.
Yeah, it's a tune. And at the time it was... That was a tune where you know where you were the first time you heard it. Like everybody I know that was raving at that time, they can remember where they were when they first heard that tune, because it was so different. It was like outstanding, this tune, the way that the beats, people had just been starting to dabble with time stretching, but this was a different, and people were using the Akai's to do time stretching, and he used an Eventide machine to do this, to time stretch the breakbeat up. And it was just unlike anything else. It was just unlike anything else at all. And so for me, that was a golden era. That was when I was on pirate radio. But I didn't get onto pirate until 91. So from 88 to 91, I was buying records, but I didn't have turntables. Didn't have any money for turntables. I'd never even touched a pair of Technics until I got onto pirate radio, because I didn't have any money. And so,
how did you know then? Did you have to learn from scratch how to mix?
My friend Trevor had turntables without pitch, so we had to physically twist the one to make it go faster and put your thumb on the platter to make it go slower. So by the time I got to Technics, it was like, this is so easy.
What, because you had the tempo?
Because you can, you know, move a thing on the side and it actually changes the speed of the record. And you can let go and it stays at that speed.
No way.
So we were like, I had a partner called Swift, who's not Mampy Swift, a different Swift. Trev, we started doing Pirate Radio 91, and immediately they were like, right, you guys can do 4 hours on a Saturday and 4 hours on a Sunday because you're really good.
Right.
And it was the first time we'd ever mixed, but first time we'd ever used pitch on turntables. But because we'd been like doing it for a year or two, just twisting it by your hand, we found it quite easy to mix on turntables.
On different decks.
He had this thing, it was what you would find in a pub at the time of people that would have the DJs with the lights in the front. So it was like one big rectangle box with two platters in it, and then two knobs. One was to turn up the volume of the right knob, and one was to turn up the volume of the left knob, and that was it. And so they didn't have any more controls or anything. And so you would put your record on, and either you'd have to play records that are the same tempo, which nowadays is a lot, but then it was not.
How did you know that? I mean, I've kind of tried to learn to mix. It's very difficult. I'm not that bad. I'm definitely not that great. But I think one of the things that I find difficult is to work out which one is faster than the other.
I think that comes after a while. You get used to, you just are able to automatically tell which one it is.
But then how do you know if you're playing two records in the same tempo if you don't have anything telling you what the tempo is? Was it on the sleeve?
No. No, records, they didn't tell you what the tempo was. It wasn't like CDJs. No, you had to listen.
That's what I'm saying. Is it like the CDJs?
You had to listen and with your and determine, using your ears and brain, which one was going too fast and which one was going too slow. And then you would use your hands to adjust them. And if you didn't have pitch, you'd have to do it by... If you wanted this one to go faster, you just twist it around, twist. And if you wanted it to go slower, you put your finger on it to slow it down. I mean, that was you had to learn how to use this stuff.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And so it took me a long time to get going, but by 93, I was kind of in full swing, and that was when Terminator Goldie came out, and I was in a rave in Leytonstone, which was in a gym, but they had a rave in there, and wow. That's when I heard it, and I was like, what on earth is this? This is just unbelievable what I'm hearing. And I was so focused on music as I wasn't interested in art, visual art, I wasn't interested in television, I wasn't interested in anything. I was really, really, really interested in music.
Yeah.
And so to hear this thing that is completely revolutionary in the thing that I'm completely focused on was just like stopped me in my tracks. I was like, oh my God, what is this?
Well, without further ado, let's get Terminator by Goldie on. So that was Goldie, Terminator. What year was that?
92 or 93.
Jeez. What I love about that track is that you can hear Goldie. You can hear his entire personality in that song.
Yeah.
Like, you can hear the way his cogs move in his brain. I love the different sections. Because we were talking about this earlier, right? And it was almost like at the time you didn't really realise there was any different sections. It all kind of flowed into it. But that's the first thing I picked up on when I listened. I was like, wow, we're going here now and then we're going there. I get everybody to choose three tracks.
Mm-hmm.
I also choose a track.
Okay.
And obviously mine is mine, as you know, is my biggest and favourite track of yours, which is Creeper. Because I remember hearing that as probably a 10-year-old.
Okay.
And 10, 11 years old. And that was the moment I got into drum and bass. I heard it through my brother's door.
Okay.
Through his bedroom door, and I remember running in and being like, what the hell is this? And I remember playing it in my middle school in art class, and I was hooked from there on.
The vocal mix?
Yes. Okay. I think Dynamite quickly became one of my favourite MCs from that point forward.
He's great, isn't he, Dino?
Yeah, I loved the fact that he could sing as well as spit.
Yeah.
I thought that was super impressive.
Yep.
And I don't know what to call him. I wouldn't call him an MC. Would you call him an MC? Well, yeah, he's Dynamite MC, but like, yeah, it's clues in the title, Beck. But
he's a good host, MC.
Exactly.
Sings. Yeah, he's
an
entertainer.
All rounder.
Yeah.
So how did you meet Dino? And
I met Dino.
How did it all kick off?
I was aware of him because of the Full Cycle, Ronnie Size. You know, I was aware of him. And he had been on Ronnie's album.
He's a Bristol boy, right?
He's a Bristol, yeah. And he'd been on the New Forms album, so I was aware of him as a performer. And I did an album in 2002, maybe, called Faster. And when I did that, I wanted to use some features, so I thought I'd like to get Dynamite to work to do a track. And I didn't think that he would say yeah. And I felt like not taking the mic, but I was like, can I really ask him to be on a track? Like, is there any chance he might say yeah? And then so I sort of did it through my agent who was the same agent or something. And they were like, well, it was my agent's assistant. She said, oh yeah, I can just email him if you want. So she did. And then it's like, yeah, he's up for it. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. Dynamite is actually up for it. So we did a track on the album that I did called Faster.
These are 2002 emails.
2002,
were they?
2003, yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's how they did
on Yahoo or AOL.
Yeah, exactly. and then after that, I did a track on his album, and then we were kind of buddies after that. And so I said to him, I've got this track, I'd like you to listen to it and, you know, maybe do a vocal on it. So he did. And that was, my studio was in Brick Lane at the time, so that's like 2005.
Oh, I lived just on the road.
Yeah, so that was, Brick Lane was a very different place from what it is now, let me tell you.
And I bet. So,
yeah, it was really, I had a studio there from 2002 to 2012.
Is that where Old Rinse was?
Exactly, yeah. In, East? Exactly, yeah, mm-hmm. In the Truman Brewery.
Yes.
So I was there from 2002 for 10 years.
That's where I met you, right? And first time? Yeah. That's where we wrote together.
Yeah. And so that was my studio originally. And then Rinse was there. And then Rinse had moved now. So,
yeah, I know. I was on Stamina MC's show so long ago.
So they're in Kingsland Road now. But yeah, so I was in... So that was in that studio there. That's where we recorded that. Where
you recorded it in on Brick Lane?
Yeah, on Brick Lane.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm glad I didn't know that at the time of our writing session. I've been gassed as fuck. Well, let's listen to it, man. This is, I know all the words. I'm not going to sing it.
Come on, Becky.
So this is Creeper by DJ Zing and Dynamite MC.
BV's by Becky Hill. 10 years and we still got the fever. One for all, we're not looking for no leader. All you got to do is know how to heat her. Dance floor, introduce you to the sweeper. Lock it down, big sound, it's the keeper. So stand clear and get ready for the creeper. Creeper, creeper.
Okay, so that was the vocal version of Creeper by you and Dynamite.
Yep. Big up Dynamite MC.
Are you...
Well done.
Isn't he?
He's a Don. He's a multi-talented, multi-genre.
He really is, because I did some uni gig in Cambridge not so long ago, and I saw him at the side of stage before I went on. And he was still there by the time I come off. Bless him, he'd watched my whole set. And he was like, oh, yeah, me and Zink are doing a remake of Creeper. You have to be on it. And I was like, bro, I'm about, man. This is what I've spent the last 15 years dreaming about. So what's that going to entail?
He's an impressive guy. It will just entail me and Diana doing the best we can do.
20 years on.
What we've got, yeah.
It's not 20 years on though, is it? But it's going to be 20 years and we've still got the fever, right?
Yeah, it's 13, 14 years. But when we made it, it was 10 years. So now it's even another 10 years. So he was, when we made it, it was 2006. And what he was saying was, it's 10 years of drum and, you know, drum and bass, and we've still got the
right.
fever.
Right.
So I think so. I think that's what he meant. We'll have to phone Dinah. But yeah, he was saying at the time, he was like, 10 years and we've still got this fever. So now it's like 20 years and we've still got the fever.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those genres that I don't think will ever stop now.
I think everything's going to stop in time, Becky, but come on, let's not get onto that.
Don't
one.
Be like that, no.
In time, all this will be gone, Becky.
No!
Yep, it's true.
I want to talk about...
The transient nature of existence. No, let's keep it simple. Let's keep it simple.
It's about music, guys. I can't start talking about the transient... I mean, I could do. But yeah, I mean, I don't know how comfortable you are with talking, and I'm sure you got asked this a lot when you first came out of Krakhouse. But what was it that made you...
How did we go from Creeper to Krakhouse?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, so this is a story. But essentially, when I got into jungle and drum and bass, this is... starting with music, like it is what it is. So I followed it all the way through. So before jungle existed, before drum and bass existed, I was into it, and so I was following the scene and completely into it. One of the things that I loved about jungle and drum and bass was that inevitably, because it hadn't previously existed, all of the people that were making the music had been somewhere else before, and so. You know,
right.
Like,
so
Leviticus Burial, Jumping Jack Frost, has got Rare Groove in it, and has got, you know, a breakbeat in it. It's got Lynn Collins breakbeat. It's got some Rare Groove in it. And then all of these different tracks had different... There were some people that had classical music samples. Some of Shut Up and Dance had classical music, and then a bit of ragga samples. And they all had breakbeats in them. But they... Because, you know, and some songs had a more techno feel. And some song had more this feel because the producers had all come from somewhere else because it hadn't existed. So,
but it wasn't.
It's like imagine you invented a new country and you get one person from every country that previously existed to go there you're going to have this real mishmash of all different food, all different this, all different that, all
which
different
what jungle was,
because everybody's bringing what they previously knew. And something that I loved about jungle was that it was always so fresh and it had such fresh influences. So come to about, you know, and that continued, and there was new, you know, like Pendulum came in. They'd come from a band background, so they had a different approach to music. I loved it.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, Ed Rush and Optical, they had a different sound. They'd come from a different background, you
yeah.
know, particularly Optical. So
I remember
all these different sounds came in, and it was like, wow, this is great.
It was very tech. I feel like Ed Rush and Optical created tech drum and bass in a sense.
They really steered the scene in a certain
they
way.
They did, yeah.
But different producers brought different sounds, and there were different trends. But one thing that I started to notice around about 2005 was that the music, a lot of the people that were then making the music had grown up on drum and bass. And so their references were drum and bass. So,
right,
so
it became almost started a bit
derivative.
Stagnant.
Yeah, it became derivative, like self-referencing. And so there was a few examples. Like there is a big drum and bass tune, right, that was an anthem. It was one of the biggest tunes around. And the guy that made it, you know, you would definitely know the tune. I said to him, I love this. It kind of reminds me of this other tune that from 10 years before. And he said, yeah, I played that tune from 10 years before in a club, but it didn't sound very good. So I thought I'd go home and kind of remake it. And that's what this new one was.
Right.
I'm not going to say what the tunes were, but essentially that kind of became a part of the scene, is that people were remaking old songs. Or
what, it became commercial in the overground?
No, not commercial, but it just, I was interested in the first time that song was made.
Right.
Not somebody remaking it, but with slightly better plugins.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? So, so there was a few times when I would notice there's a big tune in the scene, and it sounds to me exactly like something from 12 years ago, but just, you know, new, a refresh. And I felt like I've heard this before. There's not anything new. You know, I was struggling to find new stuff.
Yeah.
And I did think to myself, am I just getting a bit old? And, you know, well, the old people say, oh, new music's all crap, it all sounds the same. And I was thinking, maybe that's me. But then I said to my agent at the time, can you set me up to do a tour where I play a bit of house, a bit of breakbeat, a bit of dubstep, and a bit of drum and bass? And my agent at the time, he was like, great, what a great idea. It wasn't happening in the clubs. And I remember Shy FX played a garage tune in a drum and bass set once, and everybody was talking about, like, wow, did you hear Shy FX played so-and-so? It was like, you weren't allowed to do it. It was just, so anyway, so this is around 2006. I said to my agent, set me up with a tour. So he, because I thought I just want to have more going on, basically. And I was a bit bored with where drum and bass was. So he set up this tour, and thankfully the promoters were kind of bought into the idea. And I got to like 2 weeks before the tour, and I thought, right, let me go on Beatport, and the house I want to play, I want it to be kind of like the UK garage stuff. So it's like, you know, 4/4, but with bass lines, like Morell's Groove or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Went on Beatport. Where is it? Nope. Okay, let me go on to Tracksource. Where is it? Nope. I could not find what I wanted. And I just assumed that it existed. I assumed that there was house with bass lines. And there wasn't.
No, there wasn't. It was quite revolutionary what you did, I think, with those albums. I think that's what definitely came across for me. It was like you had, as you say, I mean, it all makes sense for me that drum and bass had kind of got a little bit stagnant for you. But you still had all these ideas, and you just didn't know where to put them because I can imagine from what you're saying, it felt like you couldn't put them into drum and bass because people were now remaking the remakes.
I just felt like I needed to be interested myself. And so, So when I realized that what I wanted to hear in house music didn't exist, I thought, I'll make it then. I'll make what I want to hear. And so that was at the same time that my son was, in the year before he started school, I decided to take a year off of work so that I could spend the year with him. Because I thought that once your kid goes to school, they kind of lose your influence and they are influenced by all their friends. So I thought, I just want to hang out with him for a year before he gets to school. So I'm really lucky that this job allows me to take a year off. So what I decided to do was, so when I did that tour, I realised that there was a sound that I was really interested in that didn't exist or I couldn't find. And so I then said to my agent, right, I'm going to take a year off. When I start again, I'm going to be making this house stuff. And I remember Scream said to me, are you going to play drum and bass when you start again? I said, no. I'm going to just do this house stuff. And he was like, that's bollocks. So I said, what do you mean that's bollocks? No, he's like, no, bruv, that takes bollocks. And I was like,
classic.
I was like,
scream,
yeah, I know.
Man.
I was like, oh, okay, cool. You know, and it's interesting because he's done a similar thing where he completely left one scene behind and moved to another and has been really successful. So in that year, I took a year off and I thought it was really like jumping off a cliff and not knowing where I was going to land, because I said to my agent, right, I'm going to take a year off and then I'm going to start making this house and there's not a scene for it and there's not anybody else making it, but that's what I'm going to do. And he was like, my agent, he was like, great, okay, let's go. You know, he was pretty up for a challenge. But within that year, I took off. And I was trying to work out, how's this going to sound? Is it like breakbeat? Is it like this? Is it like that? Is when the Crookers had that Up All Late at Night tune with Kid Cudi.
Yes. Oh, right? Day and Night.
Day and Night.
Yeah.
So they had that and they did an essential mix. And I listened to the essential mix, sort of looking for inspiration and vibes.
That was a huge tune.
That was a huge tune. And the whole mix was fine. It was all right. Except for this one tune in the middle of it. And I was like, this is what I've been looking for. This is it. Like, this is it. It's like house, but it's got a bass line. It sounds a bit like jungle, but it's got, you know, it's this is it. And so I phoned up one of the Scratch Perverts and I said to him, I was on the phone to him chatting and we're talking, he was saying, I was talking about this sound that I'm looking for. And I said, I heard one tune and it's it. This is by AC Slater. Jack Got Jacked, the Jack Beats remix,
right?
I said, I don't know who it is, but it is it. And one of the Scratch Perverts said to me, you're taking the piss. So I said, no. And he was like, that's one of the other Scratch Perverts made that. And I was like,
no way. Fucking,
I was
way.
Like, fucking hell, that is such a coincidence.
That's so strange how it can strange. Come around like that.
And so that was it. And so here it is. Jack Got Jacked, AC Slater, Jack Beats remix.
And on that note, here it is. Lovely introduction. Now let me show you how to jack beats, fuck.
That was Jack Got Jack by the Jack Beats remix by AC Slater, and that was a track I was so happy when I heard that, because I realised I'm not on my own looking for this sound. There are other people doing it, and so all of a sudden there was Fake Blood, there was FOMO, there's all these people.
Fake Blood was sick, man. I remember downloading their shit off DB9 when I was like 16 and being like, I think I like it was sick tune.
Yeah, incredible. And so it was really cool to know that I wasn't just jumping off of a cliff, and you know, there was somewhere to land, and it was this really exciting time. So I did that for a while, and I really enjoyed it, and it was nice making cutting edge music in a scene that didn't really exist. It was kind of like,
sounded, you know, so fresh, man.
Yeah, it was really fun to do. And I loved doing that and continued doing that for a while. And then more recently, it got to about 3 years ago and 3 or 4 years ago, and I started to feel like in the DJ sets I wanted to start playing a bit of jungle at the end.
I noticed, I saw this turning point with you on lineups, because it would always have in brackets jungle set.
So I started doing jungle sets, a couple of jungle sets again, and then so really in the last sort of 3 years I've started, for me, you know, drum and bass became a bit interesting again. There's a sort of a new sound that appeared.
Yeah.
That appealed to me.
I feel like there's more subgenres now in drum and bass than there ever was, with like neurofunk, with even with jump up, with tech, with all of it. I feel like there's this new wave of people like Benny L, Upgrade, Leveler. I think Leveler's making some really interesting shit right now. Like, even on the more commercial side with Dimensions and people like that, I think, like, as you say, 100%, man.
There's quite a few people, K9.
K9 is making some really fresh shit at the minute. And I feel like for the first time in drum and bass, it's got a new set of ears on it.
Yeah, it does. It feels, it's, you know, I find it appealing again. With what I do, it's not really calculated. It's just what I'm into, and I just go with it. And so more recently, I've just been more into drum and bass as well as other stuff.
Well, I think also coming back round to like the original podcast point, I think now more than ever, you can be like, when I first started raving, if somebody was to drop a halftime tune or a dubstep tune, people would put their fucking middle fingers in the air and there would be proper disgust in an audience. You couldn't do it. I remember seeing Chase and Status when they were playing they went through a little trap phase at one point, and people were really confused about the whole thing. Ravers didn't know what to do with themselves. And I think especially the switch up in tempo, dancing from 170 to then go into 140 or 130, you know, I think, but now I've seen being in the crowds and having the DJ switch up the tempo halfway through, people are so more receptive to it now.
Yeah.
And I think that's an amazing thing, and how rave has changed over the years, that you can be in that scene and you can flip up a set.
Yeah, yeah. I wish it had been 13 years ago.
I bet you going around
the country doing it, and people were standing still for most of it until their bit came in, and then they would dance like crazy.
Yeah.
And then they would stand still again. But yeah, it's great. It's really cool to see. It's an interesting thing, this podcast, you're talking about raving and that. It's an interesting thing how a big part of people's identity is the music they're into when they get to like 15, 16.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting how people can be really passionate about, they don't want to hear this, they do want to hear that. They're not, you know, my friend was into heavy metal and we stopped being friends because I was into raving and he was into heavy metal, you know, and it's kind of like that, isn't it? It's like it becomes such a big part of who you are and what you're doing, the music that you're into.
It really does, which is why I wanted to create this and kind of, because I only became more open, I suppose, to different genres when I became, like, when I came to the music industry, because
right.
I was subjected to more raves and different kind of genres and stuff. And I think it's important to educate my generation and like for anybody that is older or younger or my age or whatever. I think it's really important to get this kind of
viewpoint. It could be our mission, Becky.
I am a woman on a mission.
The multi-genre mission.
DJ Zinc.
Yeah, thank you very much for inviting me today.
Absolute pleasure to kick off this podcast. Thank you so, so much.
Pleasure, pleasure.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.